You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives. Hi, everyone. This is Allison Hitt, and we're talking today about rhetoric and composition's increasing interest in all things digital. We see this in online academic journals, new media pedagogies, a growing demand for people with tech savvy, and scholarly conversations about coding, data visualization, and other digital humanities endeavors. Colin Brook has been immersed in the digital humanities and doing work at the intersections of new media and rhetoric for years. He's the author of Lingua Fracta, Toward a Rhetoric of New Media, and on Colin Versus blog, his old website, he posted nearly 1,000 entries over the course of 5 years. He still blogs occasionally on cgbrook.net about issues relevant to the field. In today's show, Ben Kiebrick and I talk with Colin about digital publishing, the value of new media scholarship, and getting involved with the digital humanities community.
I wonder if you could describe the different types of digital publishing that you do, the extent to which you consider them academic, and what you think of as their limits or possibilities.
Sure. I guess I would say, I've done a lot of different things. I've been working with different forms of digital writing since the mid-90s. It seems like a long time to me. So I've experimented with a lot of different things. I've been keeping a blog for almost 10 years. I've experimented with what I think of as sort of more multimedia pieces. You know, I'm active on Facebook and Twitter. I'm less active as a blogger than I used to be. You know, I've published in online journals. That probably is some total of the different types. I don't think of any one type of digital writing as necessarily more academic than another. For me, obviously they have different functions. When I'm posting to Twitter, I'm not engaging in the same kind of argumentation that I am when I write a paragraph in an online essay. But I'm maybe connecting more directly with an audience there than I am when I'm sitting in my office, typing up something that may not see the light of day for a year or longer. So I guess maybe for me, the academic part of it is more in my sort of overall purposes and aims than it necessarily is in any one particular medium. As far as limits and or possibilities, I think that there are I think that a lot of the limits that we talk about with respect to social media, for example, the fact that you can't have extended, careful discussions with nuance on Twitter, for example, I think those things are pretty obvious. I don't think that we've engaged with the possibilities as much as we hopefully will over the next 5 or 10 years. I just think of the differences, for example, in the way that I read now versus 5 years ago in terms of how I find information. Last summer I wrote on my blog about kind of redoing my whole scholarly mycology, about using different software and sort of the steps that I take from starring things on Twitter to saving them in Instapaper for later reading to tagging them in Deco. This whole sort of ecosystem of tools that I wasn't using 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's no longer just a matter of waiting for the journal to arrive in my mailbox, scanning the table of contents and reading. It's a much more constant process now. And I think that one of the things that's left to do for our discipline and for scholarly communication in general is to think about how to write differently for that kind of ecology.
Yeah. You mentioned that when you're posting on Twitter, it's something different than when you're writing in the computer, and that that this piece of work might not get published a year later or a couple of years later. Does that change the types of topics that digital publishing can engage with? Does that seem like a major change to you, that you could write about something more immediate that's happening, or tie that to your scholarship?
To a certain degree, yeah. I mean, I think that, for example, there are more short-form journals online now than there used to be. I'm thinking of, for example, Present Tense or Hybrid Pedagogy or I think it's the Journal of Interactive Technology and Pedagogy that feel like they address more, they sort of follow the contours of our conversations more closely than, say, a journal article or even a conference presentation might. They tend to be more responsive to immediate circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not necessarily a difference in kind for me as much as it is a difference in degree. I mean, the essay that I write that I send to a journal still is read by other people who are my audience before I send it out. I mean, I have conversations surrounding my work with other people even when I'm writing for print. But it feels a lot more immediate and a little bit more open and flexible when I'm doing it online.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've actually gotten used to in the last, this past spring I wrote two chapters for edited collections. And in both cases, I actually wrote them in Google Docs and shared the documents with the editors before I was finished so that they could go in and start reading and give me feedback that I could incorporate into the rest of the drafting.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a much more kind of ongoing process. You know, I would much rather do that than, you know, spend all this time and effort, write the thing, send it out, 6 months later, get it back, comments. I've already forgotten sort of my thought processes as I was writing them. And I don't think I could have done that kind of sharing and that kind of open composing process. You know, I would have been really uncomfortable doing that even like 3 or 4 years ago.
In terms of the way that your thoughts on digital writing have changed, you said that you started the blog 10 years ago, the first version of it.
Yeah.
And what were some of your goals then when you set it up, as you remember, and some of the purposes then, and how has it changed as?
Back in the old days. it seems funny to talk about it that way. But it really was a different sort of, when I started blogging, there were probably only about maybe 5 or 10 other people in the field who were doing it. And I don't say that to mean that I was first, because I wasn't, but it was very sparse. And over the next couple of years, a lot of people took up blogging, and there, it got to the point where there was, I don't know, 100, 150 active blogs. And then it maybe peaked in about year 3 or 4 and then started to trail off. As kind of microblogging, Facebook, Twitter, became more popular, to the point now where I use my blog mostly now as a place for doing more kind of what I think is called medium state publishing, so longer pieces than I can comfortably fit in a Facebook update or, but not the length and sort of development of a journal article or an essay. And it's interesting, you're seeing now the development of tools. There's this tool called Medium, which is specifically for those kinds of kind of middle range publications. There are a couple of different applications that allow you to post, one of them is Tweet Longer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of in between the investment that it takes to host a blog versus the kind of quick bumper sticker speed of Twitter, finding something for that kind of middle ground. And that's where my blog is now. It used to be a lot more everyday, but my everyday stuff has kind of shifted to Facebook and Twitter. And so now it's more like once a week or a couple times a month.
So, kind of related to that, how does your website complement or supplement your other research, and how is your blog viewed by the writing program or the university in terms of scholarship?
I actually included my blog in my tenure case, and I think I was one of the earlier people to do that. I didn't include it, though, under one of the three sort of primary categories. I gave it its own category, and I had won the Fields Weblog of the Year award, I think, in 2005 or something like that. You know, so I'd gotten some recognition for it. I had a fairly healthy, steady sort of traffic through there. You know, so I cited those things. I included what I thought were some of my best and most relevant posts. You know, I think it's writing, and it's, you know, it's not the same kind of writing as the writing that I do for journals or for edited collections. But for me, it made sense to include it in the same way that you would include any kind of performance. And there are a lot of different kinds of performance sort of categories that happen at a university, and to me that was another one of them. You know, I'm a writing professor, and that's one of the places that I write. You know, and that was a part of the motivation, I think, initially for me, was, you know, you become a better writer by writing. And I think that you could say the same about sort of focusing or specializing in technology. You know, it doesn't make sense to me to talk about that kind of stuff without actually doing it.
What do you see as some of the most viable spaces for digital scholars in the future? And how would you like to see the field change around digital publishing?
I think a lot about the entire sort of scholarly communication ecosystem. And I guess I would say two things that I think I'd like to see us move towards. The first is alternative means of valuing, assessing the writing that we do. I think it's gone really, I think we've sort of, in some ways, have backed ourselves into corners in the academy by relying on a model that privileges book publication and that sort of works out of the idea of scarcity. You know, whether it's kind of impact factor or, you know, but I mean, we're not responsible for the, sort of the entire ecosystem. I think we sort of treat it as naturalized in some ways. I was talking about altmetrics, which is the idea of developing new means of judging and valuing scholarship. I was talking about that at a conference back in February, and there's this great line by a guy at Indiana, Jason Priam, who writes that today's journals are still the best scholarly communication system possible using 17th century technology. And I think that I think that line's hilarious. And I also think that we haven't given enough energy over to thinking about what that possible system might look like using 21st century technology. So even though I think there's really interesting things being done in online journals, the idea of publishing a set of 10 things together as an issue relies on the idea of it being on paper and it being cost efficient to collect them together and just send them out 4 times a year, which is fine, you know, if you're publishing a paper journal. There's no reason to hold to that model when it's online. Why not put out an essay every 2 weeks? Just simple questions like that. And that doesn't even get to the question of the fact that we value these publications when we share them on Facebook, when we retweet, when we review them in blogs, when we teach them in our courses, when we include them on exam lists. And we have so many more tools now for quantifying and sharing and identifying and recognizing our work, that restricting value to the number of times that it appears in, you know, the bibliographies of certain print journals seems like such a limited way of assessing scholarly value.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've got a lot of work to do in that direction. I think that I said that I had 2 points, and then I sort of just ran them all together. So I guess maybe the first point was actually the sort of whole scholarly ecosystem, and a piece of that would be my second point, which is the idea of altmetrics, of finding different ways to measure the stuff that we do, and also expanding the definition of what we do.
I'm also interested in the ways that digital publishing and digital writing affect the field in terms of practice as well, and like pedagogy. So could there be a field of ret comp today without digital writing as a central part of its study and practice? And what does digital writing do to change the way we understand rhetoric? And how do these digital spaces help to achieve or expand the goals of teaching composition in universities?
Gosh, there's a lot of questions embedded in there.
There are.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, I know. The easiest answer to give is that no, we can't have retcomp programs now without digital writing. And I think you're seeing that in the newest programs that are coming up, where some form of digital writing or technology is appearing more often and even in program titles, and is seen as a much more integral part of a core curriculum than you would have seen, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. You know, I think that that's definitely the direction that things are going. Part of me, though, wants to say that maybe, I don't know, it could go in a couple different directions. It could go with the idea that that's sort of another specialty, another core course. But I could also easily see it sort of just spreading throughout all courses, so that rather than being something that we actually sort of study separately in courses, it's something that just happens in all of our courses. And honestly, that's sort of the approach that I myself take. You know, for the first 7 or 8 years that I was in the program here, I think I taught a grand total of one course that was actually about technology on the graduate level. But every course that I taught was about technology, in a sense. So when I taught, I guess it's almost 7 or 8 years ago now, I taught that genre course over the summer. One of the things that I had my students do were citation maps, and they were using what visualization tools existed at the time on the web to do those projects. You know, I did sort of a kind of a distant reading version of our 611 course, the Intro to Composition Studies, where all of the students were reading and tagging separate works. And we were using class time to sort of see where the overlaps were, rather than all reading a single piece or a single set of pieces. They were, you know, blogging all of their entries. We were aggregating them in Delicious, doing visualizations of the stuff that they were reading. You know, which is kind of, I did something similar in 631, the rhetoric course that I taught. We did a 5-week unit where each week for 5 weeks, we read all of the rhetoric journals for that particular year and tagged them and aggregated them. The idea being that we would try and get a sense of what was happening in the 5 most recent years in rhetorical scholarship. You know, and those are both sort of examples of the kind of distant reading projects that are associated with the digital humanities now. So, I mean, the traditional model of the graduate course is that it's sort of an externalized version of the reading process that each of the graduate students then kind of internalize and practice themselves throughout their career. I mean, it's almost, I think of it as kind of Bakhtinian, in the sense that the dialogue, that happens in those classrooms is supposed to be the dialogue that happens in your head once you've become sort of acclimated and enculturated into academic reading. And so if we're going to argue that reading and writing are changing outside of that classroom, it makes sense to me that the classroom itself has to change too, that we can't treat the classroom as this kind of island that's unaffected by these changes in discourse that are happening all around us. You know, and for some people that may just mean, you know, using Twitter in the classroom. I'm thinking a lot about, I'm teaching our rhetoric composition and digital humanities course next spring, and I've been thinking a lot about how to sort of embed some of these practices in the classroom in ways that make it manageable for the students, but also sort of alert them to the different possibilities. So I'm thinking about like having one student every week be responsible for live tweeting the course. You know, having another person that week be responsible for just collecting resources and posting them to a Tumblr. You know, trying to sort of model the different pieces of my own ecology, but not holding them responsible for all of them at once, you know, as a brand new thing, but sort of distributing it throughout the class. You know, just to try these different practices and see how they, you know, enhance or, you know, blow up the classroom.
What advice do you have for burgeoning digital scholars and current rhetoricians interested in the digital humanities, and also for general scholars in composition and rhetoric that want to make sure that they're involved in some of the changes that have happened in the field?
Probably the best piece of advice is don't be shy. So much of the digital humanities is happening online. You can get live streams of a lot of conference talks now. The keynotes for a digital humanities conference just happened at Nebraska this past week, and the keynotes were streamed, and everyone who went to that conference is on Twitter. And so there was a lot of live tweeting of panels and stuff like that. Honestly, for the first time, just in the last couple of years, I've actually been sort of, definitely in quote marks, attending conferences online. And it's actually been a kind of an interesting process. You know, you don't actually have to be there to get a lot of the value of those kinds of activities. But honestly, there's no one or set of digital humanities programs where you have to be there to participate in those conversations. You know, there are a lot of smart blogs. There's a lot of activity on Twitter. And so much of this conversation is, you know, honestly just waiting for people to participate. And I say don't be shy because, if nothing else, the digital humanities is extremely collaborative. I think that's one of the real challenges for people who have been trained in kind of the old-fashioned sort of, you know, lock yourself in the archives or, you know, close yourself off in the office for 3 years and write a book by yourself. The digital humanities is very assertive about the fact that these kinds of projects that are being generated are the results of lots of different people coming together and, you know, sharing their skills and their talents and their expertise with each other. So it's a very conversational sort of specialty. And I think it's still very much at a place where, there's kind of a small maybe canon of texts, but there are a lot of different sort of areas. You know, I mean, I mentioned earlier distant reading, which is associated with Franco Moretti, and more recently with Matthew Jockers. You know, but there's really interesting work being done in interface design, universal design, text encoding, sentiment analysis, a lot of different subfields. There's a lot of different kinds of projects being done. My sense is that it's very open, and they really try to pride themselves on their inclusivity and and sort of willingness to help. So I don't think there's necessarily like a high bar for entry. I think what it takes is just interest and sort of a willingness to pursue that interest.
So there are lots of job postings for digital writing and new media and digital humanities. What would you think of as kind of the minimum requirements for someone applying to these jobs? What are departments looking for in terms of practical skills and a general knowledge base?
That's an excellent question. And it's actually one that I've been thinking a lot about as we've been talking here at Syracuse about kind of taking more initiative with respect to digital humanities. The short answer is that there is no one answer. There are debates about whether or not you should be able to program, and if you were to say, okay, yes, you should be able to program, then there's any number of different languages. There's a good book on digital humanities that just came out that has five co-authors. And they actually make some concrete suggestions at the end of that book for what a curriculum might look like. And some of those things are, working with data from text encoding to metadata to visualization. Some familiarity with programming languages and how they work, I would think, would be useful. Some awareness of the conversations that are happening. But really, one of the things that I think that they say, if I remember it correctly, is that digital humanities is very project-based. And it really, the skills that might be required for one project might be completely different from the skills required for a different project. And so I think it's more a matter of learning a very sort of flexible, right tools for the right job kind of thing. And I mean, so it's more a matter of knowing how than knowing what necessarily. I don't consider myself particularly expert in programming languages. I know a little bit about them, and I have my fair share of expertise when it comes to different platforms and software packages. But I also have people that I know who are more expert than I am and can help me sort of figure out what I need to know. And I think that's more valuable than knowing the stuff myself sometimes. When Derek Mueller and I were working on the 3Cs online archive, one of the things that we did was to use Perl scripts to process all of the articles and to generate word frequencies for one or two word noun phrases, nouns and noun phrases. And in order to do that, we had to put together kind of a set of Perl scripts, and neither one of us knew how to do that. And so we ended up having to spend time online finding out who knew how to do that, tracking them down, getting their help. And once it did, it was just a matter of running the scripts. But I mean, it would have taken us a year to learn how to do it ourselves. So, I mean, that's where the collaboration part of it comes in, I think. Accepting that I don't know that there's anyone who knows all this stuff, but finding the things that are going to be most important for you and most important for the particular project that you want to work on, and sort of building outward from there, I think, is probably the right strategy.
Thanks, Colin.
Sure.
Thanks,
Colin. My pleasure.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.